Oh, God, look at them all. They're staring at me. They're expecting me to deliver a sermon. I haven't planned a sermon at all. They're expecting me to take some quotidian thing that I've done in the last week, like read the newspaper or something like that, and connect it to the spiritual and the profound. I'm really not particularly interested in the spiritual and the profound. I've got nothing to say about Jesus. I don't know much about him. I don't know what they want from me. What do they want from me? They want me to sort of inspire them. I can inspire them, all right? I can inspire them with the brilliant research I've been doing. This cycle, this idea I've had of why it is populations rise and fall. It's a fantastic idea I've had. Basically, what happens is you get a small population, the population's under easy conditions, the population grows, then the population starts, then there's a famine or something, there's not enough food, and then you get a population collapse. And that's always the way it is. So you can never get good conditions long term, because there'll always be a situation where you get good conditions, the good conditions lead to a population explosion, the population explosion causes bad conditions, this means a population collapse, and that's the way of the world. I've been thinking about that a lot, but I don't know how I can connect to what they want here. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, today I'd like to talk about the importance of basically having an idle class, of having a class who can be left on their own to simply think and come up with brilliant and original ideas. In many ways, these can be connected to the genius type. The genius type, as we've discussed before, is a person who has outlier high IQ combined with moderately low agreeableness, which means he doesn't care about offending people. He doesn't care because new ideas and new inventions and new ways of seeing things will always offend against vested interests. But he doesn't care about that. And he's moderately low in conscientiousness, which means that he can sort of think outside the box. He's not rule-bound and therefore he generates new and original ideas. And being extremely intelligent, he's able to come up with these ideas. Now, that's the nature of the genius. But the genius, and sometimes also there's an element of neuroticism to the genius, so the genius worries, he's high in negative thoughts. If you are neurotic, you are thinking a lot, basically, about the future. But that could also mean that you end up thinking about brilliant new ideas. Now, that's the nature of the genius in contrast to the normal scientist. The normal everyday incrementalist scientist has reasonably high IQ combined with high agreeableness, which means that he's humble and therefore listens to other people's opinions, and high conscientiousness, which means that he's hardworking and he's very, very careful and things like that. So that's the distinction between the genius and the sort of midwit ordinary scientist. But what the genius needs to really flourish is basically a sort of safe space where he can do his genius work. And if as long as he has that safe space, then he'll be fine and off he'll go, and he'll be able to work away at doing his genius work and whatever, and not have to worry about the more everyday things in life, because the genius is often bad at everyday things in life. It's been shown, as we have discussed before, that intelligence is a bit like a pyramid. At the base of the pyramid, there's very ordinary things like catching a ball or doing up your shoelaces or driving a car or whatever, that are weakly correlated with intelligence. Then you get linguistic, verbal, spatial and mathematical intelligence that are more strongly correlated with G, and then you get G, the general intelligence that underpins all of them. And as you become more intelligent, the positive manifold between these different components of intelligence gets weaker. And this explains the sort of nutty professor phenomenon, whereby a person who is, Sheldon Cooper, whereby a person who is extraordinarily intelligent can nevertheless be completely incompetent when it comes to quite everyday things. So what these geniuses need is a sort of safe space where they could just be permitted to just do whatever they want in the hope that they will come up with the necessary genius ideas. Now, what that also means is that a lot of people will end up being put in that safe space and they won't come up with brilliant ideas. They'll just be lazy and just sort of take advantage of the situation. But it pays for itself as long as some of them are able to come up with these brilliant ideas. Now, it could be argued that we used to have this with the university. The university used to provide this safe space. But before the university did that, there was a time when the university was basically based until certainly the late 19th century, when British universities were not interested in science or new ideas at all. They were basically just an expression of the church, an outpouring of the Church of England and a way of upholding the Church of England. And so you would be in trouble if you had genuinely original ideas as an academic. But what you did find is that there was a class of people in the 18th and 19th century in England called vicars. And that offered a fantastic space for genius for people. Because in most cases, being a vicar or being a rector, i.e. being the parish priest, was a sinecure in which you didn't really have to do much work at all, but yet you got a huge amount of money. It was a very interesting book on this called At Home by Bill Bryson. And he looks at the way that in 1851, which was the year, by the way, in which a complete amateur designed Crystal Palace, in 1851, there were 17,621 clergy operating in England. On average, they had a parish with each of them with 250 people in it. And the average income for these people was £500, which was an enormous amount of money. This did not come from payment from the church, but rather it came from lands which were owned by the church, which came with the so-called benefice, and from rents from these lands, and of course from tithing, whereby the people in the parish had to give 10% of their tax, 10% of their income, to the parson, to the vicar. To give an example of this, Jane Austen was the daughter of a vicar. She lived in a 7-bedroom house in Hampshire, and she was considered quite sort of poverty-stricken by the standards of a vicar of the day. The most extreme example was in Doddington in Cambridgeshire. In 1851, this came with 38,000 acres of land, and the income for the vicar was £7,300 a year from these rents and these tithes. Now, in order to become a vicar, you needed to have a university degree by this time. That hadn't been the case a few hundred years earlier, but it was the case by this time. But this didn't necessarily have to be in theology, and it usually wasn't. It was usually in classics or something like that. So in essence, these people had absolutely no training as a vicar. They had no pastoral training. They didn't have much knowledge of theology. It wasn't even considered particularly necessary for them to do so. They had no training in writing sermons. And in fact, often they would just get a big book of sermons once a year and read out the relevant sermon to their congregation. So what you basically had was a group of extremely educated, extremely intelligent people with a job where they didn't really have anything to do. All they had to do, I mean, there was plenty of things they could do, but there wasn't actually anything they had to do. And so this meant that if they wanted to, they could just do absolutely nothing. Or if they wanted to, they could dedicate their time to their interests. And in some cases, this meant that being a country parson, you have what's called the scholar rector. You had the perfect room for genius. All of the everyday things which genius people are no good at, like, you know, the practical things and money and stuff like that, were taken care of for them by the parish, by the church, by the other officers of the parish, whatever. All they had to do was do these occasional rituals and, you know, look holy, basically. Rather like in an Orthodox church today, you know, just sort of go through the rituals. And otherwise, they could pretty much do what they liked. And they did. So there are numerous examples of massive contributions to British life that have been made by these vicars. George Baildon of Yorkshire turned half his church into a hen house because nobody used it. He then taught himself Icelandic and produced the first ever English to Icelandic dictionary. Lawrence Stern of York wrote extremely successful novels, The Life and Times of Tristan Shandy being one of the most famous of them. Edmund Cartwright of Leicestershire, he was a vicar, this is very important, He invented the power loom, of which there were 250,000 in use in England by 1851. So he made a massive contribution to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, Edwin Cartwright, this was hugely important in the industrialisation of Britain, the power loom. So his contribution kind of can't be overstated. In Devon, there was somebody called, a vicar called Jack Russell, who bred the dog of the same name. In Oxford, there was one William Buckland, who wrote the first serious and detailed description of dinosaurs and was also an expert on coprolites, that is to say, fossilised excrement, and the information that can be drawn from, of course, their passers about those. In Surrey, there was Thomas Malthus, who I was channeling earlier, who came up with the concept of the Malthusian cycle, which is this idea that of how populations rise and fall. When the population, when there's a small population, there's a good standard of living, but because there's a good standard of living, the population rises. Eventually, the population is too large to be sustained by the amount of land, and then inevitably there is a plague and a famine and whatever, and the population collapses down again. And this always happens, or at least it did until the Industrial Revolution, when the pace of production, and therefore the pace of the increase in living standards, could outpace the pace of population growth. In Dorset, there was somebody, William Greenwood of Durham was a leading contribution to archaeology, and also the main trout fly in fly fishing, the Greenwald Glory, was named after him. In Dorset, there was Octavius Picard Cambridge, who was an expert on spiders. There was William Shepherd in Dorset as well, who wrote the first dictionary of dirty jokes. In near Manchester, there was George Garrett. Again, this is another hugely important contribution. He invented the submarine. There was John Mackenzie in Berkshire, who made huge contributions to the invention of the hot air balloon and to aerial photography. There was Serene Barry Gould, who wrote the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers and the first novel featuring a werewolf. There was Gilbert White of Hampshire, who was the one of the major naturalists of his day. There was an M.J. Barclay of Northamptonshire, who was the world expert on fungus. There was a John Mitchell, who made a telescope for William Herschel, the astronomer, and through which, using that telescope, William Herschel discovered the planet Uranus. There's just so many. And of course, one of the most brilliant ones, of course, was one Thomas Bayes, of Tunbridge Wells in Kent, who lived from about 1701 to 1761, and he came up with Bayes' theorem, which is a hugely important contribution to mathematics. And there are just loads and loads and loads of these people. Because, okay, on the other side, this book mentions somebody called one particular vicar who didn't do very much. Somebody by the name of Woodford, who wrote the diary, Reverend James Woodford, who wrote the diary of a country parson, and he just wrote in detail about what he did, which was just basically a life of partying and meeting local notables and just eating lots and lots of food. And he described in detail, in fine detail, all of the, you know, the gluttony, all of the different kinds of expensive and fascinating food which he consumed. And this diary was published in about 1924, I think it was, and it was a bestseller. People were fascinated by the sort of decadent life of a Victorian country parson. And so, yes, in many cases, they didn't. These parsons had this incredibly wonderful life, but they didn't really do very much with it. But the point is, it could be argued that is more than outweighed by the massive contributions of these geniuses and semi-geniuses who were only able to come up with their genius work, who were only able to do their thing because they had this space in which they were just looked after and, you know, had fed and watered, basically, and in which they could therefore pursue their genius work. Now, what happened by the 1850s, of course, is that this went into decline. With the Industrial Revolution, people moved away from the villages, people stopped going to church, people moved away from the farms, all of the money went into industry, and all of these parishes went into decline, and the churches were shut down, and you ended up with team ministries, and ministers in charge of numerous churches, and ministers with tiny little congregations, and all of this sort of stuff. And then it radically changed. Then the ministers actually had work to do, and of course also being a priest was then no longer attractive to highly intelligent people anymore. I mean, being a priest in the 1700s and early 1800s gave you a great deal of status and money. Once it stopped giving you status and money, then the only people that were going to be attracted to it were going to be really, really, really religious people. And so it stopped having status and it went into decline. Now, there was a period, however, when one could argue that the genius transferred over at about the time that the country parsons went into decline, transferred over to the universities. Because by about 1871, the English universities, people didn't respect them. They didn't do academic work. They were basically considered to be finishing schools for the upper classes. Although there were even there a few people that were fellows at universities, such as Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland, who, of course, had all this time on their hands and were able to produce fantastic stuff, though it wasn't necessarily academic stuff. But you you did have a period in which the universities of Oxford, Cambridge, and Durham then changed, and they tried to imitate the German and Dutch universities, which were highly academic. And so there came this idea that they should be a sort of safe space for geniuses. And so you'd have these academics that worked at these universities, and in theory they were supposed to be doing their research. In practice, they weren't really doing that much at all. But that is why, in the case of C.S. Lewis, they had time to write fantastic children's novels, The Chronicles of Narnia or whatever, and other theological literature. It is why, in the case of J.R.R. Tolkien, they had time to invent languages and things like this. So there was a period in which the university was a bit like being a country parson. It was a safe space for people of a sort of genius, creative bent. But then the universities started to change. They started to compete internationally. It started to be based around how much research output you could do. They bureaucratized, and suddenly now, if you're an academic at a university, you have to spend all your time on research. You have to publish loads and loads and loads of stuff. You have to go to conferences. You have to do all these things that are basically anathema to geniuses. Plus, of course, as we've discussed before, there is the wokeification of universities, where you know, dogmas and equality and harm avoidance are placed way above truth, and the result of that is that the genius type who is obsessed with truth cannot cope with the speech codes and whatever, and is driven out of the university, and so there is no current safe space for him. It was the rectory. The university at that point wasn't a safe space, because if you weren't careful with what you said, then you could get in trouble. It was the rectory. Then it was the university, and now there is no particular safe space for these genius types at all. And so what that could potentially mean is that various geniuses, unless they can find independent funders or whatever, will not reach their potential. They will not reach their genius potential because there is no safe space for them to be in. But it's very, very interesting the way that it worked, which is that you have a system of sanctification of something being religious and unquestioned, and you have this idea that therefore those that are involved in it should are so looked up to and respected that we should give them a large salary, and we should just accept that they'll just do whatever they like. You know, they'll spend all their time praying or whatever, and then you get a change in the society such that people become less religious, but there is a lag, there is a period where they're not expected, where no one really cares if they spend all their time praying, because people are just sort of going through the motions and stuff like that, and they just like it for cultural reasons. And in that lag, where no one really cares about them doing that, then they are able to dedicate their time to their genius work between, I don't know, the late 1700s and the mid 1800s, something like that. Then similarly, at the universities, you seem to have this lag. You have the sanctification of the university and the idea that it's almost semi-holy, the idea that the university is about the pursuit of truth, that ultimately it's about revealing God's creation. And that belief, and therefore they need to have some sort of safe space where they can do that. That belief in God's creation wanes, but giving them a sort of a safe space where they can just do whatever they like doesn't, and therefore you have a period where they are allowed to question religious dogmas and whatever and do whatever they like, until of course it changes and this belief in truth declines, and you have these belief in equalitarian values and this lack of belief in religiosity, and thus a rise in the importance of money and bureaucracy and whatever, and therefore it collapses. So what we need to promote genius is a new sinecure. We need a new non-job. And I don't know whether one day the non-jobs of diversity officer, where I'm assuming you don't really have to do very much, when that religion starts to die out, if those non-jobs will be attractive, there'll still be this holiness attached to them, and therefore people will just use those non-jobs to do whatever they like and make important contributions. I don't know. But certainly the contribution of the scholar-rector to English life cannot be overstated. If you look in the Dictionary of National Biography, according to the book I mentioned earlier, and you use the word rector, it comes up 4,600 times. A further 3,300 for vicars, but only 492 for physicists. So they obviously made hugely important contributions. So to those that would say that religion is antithetical to science, there is a degree to which that's true, but it seems to be that it's the balance between the two that is important. If you are too strong in group-oriented values, the values that were promoted by Christianity, then you suppress criticism and whatever, and you have what Oxford University and Cambridge University were like until the 1870s. If as you don't, and you suppress genius, and they're not a place for genius. If you are too strong in these equality values, these individualising values of equality and harm avoidance, and again, you suppress genius. There needs to be a balance between the two. And that is what it seems we had for a period of time at our universities. And is what it seems that it allowed us to unleash or unlock with these scholar rectors. Well, I hope this has been of interest. If it has, please do subscribe. It helps me most violently if you do that. Please remember I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. If you want to help the channel, you can see ways to do so below. And I will see you soon. And goodbye. And God bless you.